This is episode 3 of the Nothing Human podcast. Three Powers of the Human Spirit, Part 3, How the Powers Relate in Individuals and Community.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. This is part 3 of our series on the three powers of the human spirit. Today we're going to talk about how the powers relate in individuals and in community, sort of how they interact both within you as an individual, but also how they interact a little bit within the community dynamics that develop. And we did discuss this a little bit last episode, a little bit about how communities can put pressures. We talked about the primacy of the intellect and how that has put a lot of pressure on people to at least pretend to care first about intellectual concerns, even if that's not actually their first power. But today we're going to talk a little bit about how those things interact. So last week we did say that it is not really wrong or incorrect necessarily to have one power be in front of the others. That's just the way it is. That's a descriptive reality of human beings, that everybody has a lead power. But today we're going to dig into that a little bit further. And I wanted to start by talking about what I like to call like the throne room of the spirit, because this is often how I think of it. And started thinking about this a little bit when I was reading Bessel van der Kolk's really good book called The Body Keeps the Score. And in it, he discusses a few different therapeutic models. And one of the ones that he mentions and talks about in that book is the internal family systems therapy. It's a way of talking about the sub-personalities, the various different actors that are inside the self-conscious mind or heart, and that they interact. And he talks about how there are kind of parent sub-personalities and child sub-personalities and partner sub-personalities. So in internal family systems therapy, they'd oftentimes get people to act out those parts so that the person who is dealing with a particular psychological problem, they would be able to talk to and interact with their sub-personalities and see them outside of their minds, externalize it so they can actually see how these things are interplaying. And he talked about how there was a good bit of freedom and therapeutic value in that. I'm not necessarily recommending that. But the throne room of the spirit idea is something similar, where if you think about your internal self-consciousness or self-awareness as being this sort of throne room, and there is a ruler, a leader in there, in this throne room, sitting on the throne, and there is the minister or the partner that is helping to enact the leader's plans. And then there is usually a subject power, you know, some sort of person who is being either acted upon or acted for. I have this idea that in your individual self, internally, you have a leader power, a partner power, and a subject power. And again, as we talked about last episode, that leader power could be any different of the three. Could be will, could be intellect, could be affections. Before we get into a little bit more of that, of how those can interrelate and what it looks like when one is a leader or the other is a leader, let's talk a little bit about standards. One of the things that's necessary for all three powers is a standard. We talked about how the goal of the will is the pursuit of righteousness. and the goal of the intellect is the pursuit of truth, and the goal of the affections is the pursuit of good, material good, life. But you need a standard in order to determine not only what goal you're running toward, but also to give you feedback as you're going of your relationship to that standard, whether or not you're actually making progress toward it or aligning with it or not. This is not to say that every will is pursuing God's righteousness, or every intellect is pursuing God's truth, or every affectional person is pursuing God's good, the ultimate good. That's not necessarily the case, right? It's just that they need some kind of a standard. Sometimes those standards are not very good. But one way or the other, they have an idea of what is right. The will has an idea of what is right. The intellect has the idea of what is true. And the affections have some idea, some imagined idea, some ideal form of what is good or what is beautiful. There are two different kinds of standards that individuals might have, and this plays into personality pretty heavily. Because if you as an individual have an internal standard versus an external standard, an internal standard is one that you come to on your own terms that might actually be in contradiction to the community standard around you, but one which you follow and pursue on your own terms. So if you're an internal standard will-oriented person, you might be described as willful or strong-willed or stubborn. If you are a person, however, on the other side, who's will-oriented, but you get your standard from external standards, from authoritative sources, from somebody telling you, hey, this is what is right, then you might be called disciplined or dutiful. And you can see that even though these are very different kinds of people, on one side you have the rebel who follows it, you know, the beat of his own drum, the nonconformist, you know, this person who just does his own thing. And then on the other side, you have this person who follows the rules really carefully, very, very dutiful, rule-keeping person. They both could be will-oriented, but because the rebel or nonconformist has an internal standard, his will is operating in a different way in relationship to his community than the external standard will-oriented person who's very disciplined and dutiful and who cares about what his community says in terms of whether or not he's meeting that standard properly. So this is actually really important to keep in mind. Because if there is antagonism between people, it's oftentimes between external standard people and internal standard people. Let me give you an example. I mean, what we just said. If you're an internal standard, willful, strong-willed person, the likelihood is that there's going to be a huge amount of suspicion directed at you from a community of external standard people. And let's just get this out of the way right off the bat. Internal standard people are rarer than external standard people. There are the nonconformists, the innovators who come up with all sorts of various different things from ideas that they have pursued themselves in terms of what is right or good or true. And then there's a lot of other people who might say, hey, that's a good idea. And then they follow after it and they teach their kids to, and through mimetic learning, like we talked about, through imitation, they propagate that standard that was once internal, and now it has become a community standard that then applies to the community at large and becomes a sort of standard that everybody believes that's what we should follow. Well, aside from if there's another nonconformist who shows up to kind of juice the system again and give it a little bit more life. But of course, that internal standard person is going to be viewed with suspicion as a rebel against the community standard, even if that community standard was at one point the idea of some prophet, innovator, visionary, rebel, nonconformist from the past. So this would explain why Jesus says, you have built monuments to the prophets your fathers murdered. Meaning, when that first prophet came along into the community, the people who were dealing with him as an innovator, someone who's coming in and saying, hey, thus says the Lord, and it's against what all you guys are believing, but hey, this is what's true, then everybody was like, ah, you're very suspicious. We don't like you very much. You're telling us things that are very out of accord with what we've accepted as authoritative, and so we're going to stone you or hang you or, you know, throw you off a cliff or cast you out of the community. And then the kids or whatever, you know, maybe someday down the road when that internal standard guy, that innovator is no longer around, the children of the people who killed that prophet are saying, hey, this has become the external standard. This has become the community standard that we all agree with. And all of a sudden, what used to be nonconformist has become the standard for everybody. So you can see how that works out. you can see how it works out both for strong-willed versus disciplined people, but there's also rule-following academics, people who receive an authoritative standard and say, hey, this is what I believe to be true because it has been confirmed over many, 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 many years. It is the consensus of the scientific community, this kind of thing. But then obviously you have those scientists who come in and say, I don't care what the consensus is, Galileo, I'm going to go ahead and follow after this completely other idea that's almost opposed to the community standard, to the consensus. But, you know, it turns out over time, a lot of times those innovators are correct. And then that becomes the standard. That becomes the consensus. And so then this also can obviously happen with tastes. I mean, you see that all the time with people who are, you know, cooks who follow the same recipe over and over and over and over and over again. And then you have a chef who comes in who has his own thing going and he's like, hey, I got a different way to do this. And he innovates. And then eventually maybe that standard becomes, or, you know, that what was once individual and internal becomes an external standard that everybody else applies to. And you can see how that changes cuisines and cultures over time in the realm of the good, connected to the affections. So you need a source of a standard, and you also need a feedback metric of your relationship to that standard, and both of those are either going to be internal and or external. So if you have an internal source of a standard, meaning I kind of follow the beat of my own drum, then you're also going to have a feedback metric for your relationship to that standard that is also internal, meaning you're going to have to determine for yourself whether or not you have betrayed your own principles, whether or not you are following your own ideas, whether or not you are actually in keeping with and approved by the standard that you have held in your mind. Whereas with an external standard person, they also have a source that's external. Maybe it's from the community or from some authoritative standard or text. And they receive that, and they need a feedback metric as well. And it's also usually external, meaning there is a bureaucracy or an administration or an institution that tells them you are either in accord or out of accord with the standard. And usually people are working to remove those discrepancies over time. They don't want to be out of accord with that standard. So either, you know, to my own self, I must be true on the side of internal standards, or in terms of external standards, you're saying, I need to get in accord with the community. I can't be an outcast. It feels terrible to do that. So you can see how those very different personalities there, even in the same exact power, based on whether or not they're drawing on an internal standard or an external standard, an individual standard or a community standard. So how do you judge a standard in any kind of an objective way to determine whether or not that standard for that power is actually good or functional? And I've come up with a way, and really, this has to do a little bit with the nature of the powers. So if the powers are spiritual, then the ultimate standards for each of the powers must also be spiritual. And that which is spiritual transcends time and space, ultimately. And so the limitations of a standard for a power tends to be the limitations of its time and space. So let me give you an example of this, because it's a little bit weird, I understand what I'm saying. But by expanding the scope of your space or the time frame of your time, you get closer and closer and closer to what would be considered a universally applicable standard. So an example of this, if you were to go and you were to ask a meth addict whether or not meth was a good, so you're asking them, you know, hey, use your affectional capacity, and based on your taste, is meth a good? Most meth addicts are going to tell you it is a good, and in a sense, it is, because if you're just talking about that one person and only in a very short, limited period of time, it brings extraordinary pleasure and seems to direct them to life. They feel better. They're free from pain for this short period of time. But as soon as you start to expand the scope of your space, or expand the scope of your time, you begin to realize that that's not a sufficient standard, that your standard hasn't been sufficient for determining whether or not methamphetamines are a good. Because even if you just add a couple of days, or a month, or 2 months, and you say, hey, do you think it's still a good? I mean, even if they're still saying, yeah, it's a good, it's the only good I have, you can see very clearly that that limited standard has failed them, because they've lost their job, they've lost their relationships, they've lost everything they have, they've lost their teeth, they've lost their health, they're in bad shape. This has obviously not produced life in them if you just expand that time frame just a little bit. And same with space, you know, it might be good for them individually, but as soon as you expand that space out, even to their house, which is a wreck, or to their relationships in their community, which have been totally broken, you can see that if you just expand that out in space, is this good for everybody, or is this good for the cosmos? You can say, no, methamphetamines are not good for the cosmos, and they're not good for any kind of extent of time. So they're not ultimately pursuing the good. One of the failures of Aquinas in this, and I hate to talk about Aquinas' failures because you should probably know I do like Aquinas. I like him as a person. Like, I want to meet him in heaven and talk with him and just hash some things out with him, because I really like the way his mind works, the care of it, and the particularity. But I do disagree with him on this. He tends to put the affections in terms of being outside of these intellectual faculties, which he puts the will even with the intellect, so take that for what it is, because of the fact that he says the object of it or the goal of it is not universal enough. So he talks about, like, the point of the intellect is to search for truth, and that's universal, right? But he says that the appetite or the affections are just oriented towards bodily good, and so that's not universal. And so obviously then you wouldn't necessarily say that that's as powerful a spiritual power, right? He doesn't even really include it in that same intellectual category. He puts it in the sensitive appetites, meaning the bodily appetites. But I would disagree with him on this, because I think, for one, you could say that there are limited truths, contextual truths, relative truths that are true in a very limited way, but aren't true for all time or in all spaces. And so in that sense, you could say, well, truth also could have a limited object and not a universal object, depending on what you're talking about in terms of truth. Like, not every single truth claim has to do with universals. And so there's that. But then the other side of it is that there actually is a universal good, which he himself even knows, which is God, meaning God is life. The Holy Spirit is the Lord and giver of life. And therefore, we would say that ultimately to pursue good in an ultimate sense is to pursue the good of God, meaning to pursue the Holy Spirit and communion with the Spirit. And we would say the same thing with righteousness, that there are limited applications of righteousness, a good rule for a particular context that doesn't necessarily hold for all cultures or all time or all spaces. But there is also a standard of righteousness that is ultimate and above all of that that we are pursuing. And it is also, as you can imagine, in God. So God is our standard of righteousness, ultimately. He's ultimately our standard of truth, and he's ultimately our standard for what is good or life-giving. And so any standard that you use that's less than that is going to be limited. But relatively speaking, if you can expand your time and space from a little bit beyond good for me or true for me or right for me right now, even if it's just like good for me or right for me or true for me 5 years from now, as well as right now, all of a sudden, you know, even just by expanding that time a little bit or expanding that space, good for me, but also good for my family, but also good for my tribe, good for my community, good for my state, good for my nation, good for the world. As if you can expand it out more and more and more, you can see that you're getting closer and closer to a better standard, a closer standard to that universal standard. Now, our limitation is that we are finite. So our access to and ability to apply a universal standard in a particular context is very limited. We are limited. We are finite. And so that's one of the necessities then, if you desire to have this feedback, right, of what's my relationship to the standard, that really ultimately, whether you're an internal standard person or an external standard person, it should be the case that God ultimately, whether the indwelling spirit and the illumination of the scriptures and the rebuke of a community that you take into account, even if you're convinced in your own mind, you need that. You need that in order to have some sort of a feedback metric of whether or not you're in keeping with the standard of the truth or the good or the righteousness that is in God. And if you're an external standard person, you need the same thing. You need to understand that it is good to follow after conventions to some extent and to be at peace with all men as much as it depends on you. However, at the same time, there are times when what is righteous from God or what is good from God or what is true from God puts you at odds with your community. And it's going to take more courage for you than it would be for an internal standard person to actually defy the expectations of a community when you're not meeting those community standards and instead have to obey God rather than men. So you can see, I hope, that that creates a whole lot of variety within all of the various different ways that the powers can interact. Because, you know, mathematically, there are only six possible configurations of power order. But as soon as you take into account that you could have an internal standard or an external standard for all six of those, then that means there are actually 12 basic personality types. And I won't bore you with the word salad of just going through and saying each one of those in order. I'm pretty sure you can figure it out, and a chart would probably help you better. But I will give you an example of one of these personality types, so one of the 12. So let's say your intellect, affections, and will. Let's just talk about this real quick, because I'm not going to do this with everyone, but I'm very familiar with this one for reasons you can probably surmise. But if you're an internal standard, intellect, affections, and will, you are going to be a visionary. You're going to be a prophetic type, visionary type, and your affections are going to serve your intellect as the partner power in understanding and empathy. So again, the intellect's purpose is truth, and so when the affections are partnering with the intellect, with this particular type, what ends up happening is the affections are serving the intellect in its goal of pursuing truth. And the affections are very useful in that because empathy increases understanding. I can put myself in another person's shoes and understand experiences that are beyond myself. And so you can see also that the affections might add to the intellect all sorts of sources like literature and art and all sorts of analogies that draw in and help the intellect to understand the world better. But in this case, there are things the affections are going to contribute to the intellect that aren't really all that useful to the pursuit of truth. And so the truth is basically, as the lead power, going to say to the affections, hey, you know, and we don't really need that, you know, and that can happen, obviously. And then when the will is the subject power, it can be viewed as a liability in that it limits and tries to rule the imagination, right? So there's the sense in which the intellect is trying to reach out and imagine all that can be imagined through the powers of its experience that are provided by the affections and the taste that it has provided by the affections and the empathy that it has provided by the affections. And it's reaching out, trying to get as far as it can. It's curious about everything. It wants to understand everything. And sometimes the will can be viewed as a liability in that, where it comes in, it says, actually, thus far and no further, you shouldn't be investigating these things. These are things that are not belonging to you, that haven't been given to you. And so the visionary oftentimes can also be the madman if he overruns his will to such an extent that he's going beyond the limits and beyond the rules and starts to delve into the occult or other kinds of Gnostics, you know, basically secret knowledges, because he's not willing to limit himself and be limited, then he can move into madness and sorcery and all things like that. And that is like the false prophet, right? So that's when the prophet has gone bad. But that's why the will also, even as a subject power, can be an asset, because it creates discipline and boundaries and foundations that limit the sort of unending reach of the intellect to those things that are actually useful and productive and that have been given by God. For instance, the secret things belong to God, the things revealed belong to us and to our children that we might obey them. And so it's very important then that the visionary be kind of reined in. And by this, I'm talking about the intellect, affections, will guy who has an internal standard is a visionary. So you can see that's a little bit of a portrait of what that might could look like with those interactions. Okay, so it is really interesting then that if there are 12 basic personality types, it makes a lot of sense why you have this representation of humanity in the Tree of Life or in the nation of Israel or in the apostles or in the 12 elders, this idea of like 12 being this figure of humanity in service to God. That they're actually, it seems to be the case that you have these 12 basic personality types kind of covering in a plenary way the whole of human possibility within these three powers. And I think one of the things that is lacking in, let's say, the Enneagram is that it's based on 9 basic personality types. And if any of you have ever taken the Enneagram and you feel like, I'm kind of missing from this, I don't really feel totally served by this category, these categories, Or I feel like these categories kind of overlap here and there and et cetera. I think it's because of this. I think that there are some missing bits of information in terms of what's possible for human personality. And so when I'm looking for categories, and since this is a podcast about thought categories, I'm always trying to think, are these categories actually covering all the different possibilities? Like, is this full? Is this fully populated? So when you have a plenary category, what that means is that the categories that you've chosen actually cover all of the options. And I would say the main weakness in the Enneagram is that I do not believe it is plenary categories. It does not cover all the various different options. And I think the reason for that is that there are 12 basic personality types, not 9. So I'll let you do a little bit of the work. I did a little bit of the work with intellect affection as well. I'm most familiar with that. And but you can really see, I mean, I could go down into one of the will-oriented ones. And let's say if you're will first, meaning you're most concerned with righteousness first, but you have intellect as your partner power. So sitting on the throne is will, and then partnering as minister is the intellect. And then you have the affections as the subject power, sort of, you know, being ruled over and ruled by, and in some ways being viewed as a little bit of a liability. Additionally, let's say that this person has their standard externally, and so their standard of righteousness comes from either the community standard or from some other source beyond themselves. Well, in this case, you might have somebody who's like a judge. So the judge is, of course, most concerned with right and wrong. I mean, that's what his job is. But a judge also is very much interested in the facts. So secondary to what he needs to accomplish as a judge is I need to collect the facts and I need all the facts that are relevant. And so I need my intellect to partner with my will to determine what relevant facts are necessary to make a good judgment on right and wrong. And so the judge might be will first, but his intellect could be very powerful in partnering with him in order to investigate what needs to be investigated in order to come to the right judgment. Now, you can also see that the affections could be seen as a liability in this particular type because, again, the judge is not supposed to be partial. So if his affections or his feelings start to play into whether or not he's able to make a right judgment, he has to sort of set those aside to some extent. And so, again, there can be this idea of like the cold and self-righteous judge who's unfeeling in the execution of his job. And that's because, you know, potentially those affections down there as the third power are actually, in a sense, being cut off or rejected. Now, they do provide, obviously, a lot of value in the judge in that it gives him some degree of humanity and sympathy for the people that he is judging over so that he is not just running roughshod over the life concerns of the individuals that he is judging, but instead is actually taking into account the value of the lives that he is judging between and determining what is actually good, also not just right, but also good for the people involved. I hope you can also see that the external standard is at play here because the judge isn't able to just make up the law on the basis of whatever he thinks personally. He is receiving a law from outside of him and he has to make a judgment that's in keeping with that law. A person with this same kind of personality order of the will and the intellect and then the affections that has an internal standard might actually make a better lawyer than judge because he's trying to find a way of constructing the law in a way that benefits his clients. And sometimes, it's interesting, is almost like in conflict with the judge in a sense, trying to compete against the judge.
All right. And so then you might have somebody who's like affections first, right? So they're most interested in the good. They're most interested in pursuing what is good. And then secondarily, they have this, the will, let's say. So that's their partner power. And then the subject power is the intellect.
And let's say like with our judge, this person has an external standard. But in this case, it is of good, meaning what is the good life or what is good?
This might be somebody like a philanthropist. So they're first and foremost concerned with life and with the pursuit of life and with good things. And though, awesomely, they have the secondary power, this partner power of the will that is able to help them produce and acquire good things. Because the will is, you know, has this power to go out and choose and to make things happen. And so the affections, they're saying, hey, we want life. And the will comes in and says, we will go get it. And if it's properly ordered and it's not selfish, then that would make for a really good philanthropist, because they care about the lives of others, they care about their own lives, but they also have the power to acquire wealth and to distribute it and to make good choices and to manage things well because of their partner power in the will. The subject power, the intellect for this particular personality type of the philanthropist, might actually end up becoming a liability, as it often is with an affections-oriented person. You've probably heard the phrase, facts don't care about your feelings. And oftentimes, intellectual information, truths that can pop up or bubble up to the surface, oftentimes do produce a certain kind of pain or a certain kind of discomfort about the reality of things, about how things actually are. And that can really puncture a hole in the optimism of a philanthropist. Again, though, the intellect obviously is useful in all stages of this, in that it is able to tell you where there are needs, where there are opportunities, and other things like that. So again, these subject powers, even though they can be considered liabilities, are oftentimes asked to provide services for the partner and the leader powers. And if they're not abused, if they're not put down, they can be very useful in that area, but of course, they are going to be the subject. They're going to be the lowest on that order, not just because of the weakness of it potentially, but also because of the potential of disruption to the goals of the affections or the will or the goals of the higher powers if that subject power ends up getting a little bit, you know, too big for his britches and telling you things that you don't want to hear. And again, you can see that this happens sometimes, right? With the throne room, if you go back to the throne room of the spirit, if you got this king that's on the throne and you got the advisor sitting right next to him, he's saying, hey, the subjects, the peasants are restless. You know, the subjects are planning a revolution. We got to keep them down. We got to make sure that they don't get too restless and maybe try and take over the country or something like that. If it's well ordered, still, they don't necessarily have a huge amount of influence on the decision making up top. But if it's tyrannical or disordered, you can see that those subject powers are often the first to be abused, to be totally neglected, dismissed, rejected, suppressed even. And we'll talk about that. Let's also talk a little bit about self-awareness and community pressure. Self-awareness, if you're sitting here and you're like, which of these 12 basic personality types am I? That's a great question to be asking yourself, and I think that you should do as much work as is necessary in order to try and figure that out. But let me just tell you that in terms of self-awareness, and this is not like a lot of personality types, these things can change. You know, you might find that in a certain context, because of the things that are being required of you, let's say you're a mother and you just had your first child and that child needs you, you're going to find that the affections and the will are going to serve you a whole lot better in those particular early days in terms of just like pushing through, persevering, etc. And it might be the case that even if you are a scientist or whatever else, that you have to sort of set aside that main power for a little while in order to raise up some of your other powers to deal with the needs of that moment or that context. So that sometimes can make it really difficult for people to assess what they actually are, because it might be that they're in a season in life where, naturally speaking, the orders of their powers are having to sort of be obscured for a time so that they can accomplish some things that need to be accomplished. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is that there are a lot of community pressures. Like we talked about last episode, if you live in a community that has primacy of the intellect as their main power, where the community has a standard where they say this is the most important power, it's really hard to function in that community if that particular power is your subject power. So for instance, if you are one of the personality types that actually has intellect last, and you happened to exist in a community where intellect is first, primacy of the intellect, like in most Western communities, you might find that you are greatly devalued in your community, and you might also find that you spend a lot more time and do a lot more work trying to rise up the power, the absolute power of that subject power, and might even get to the point where you get it up to a second power or get it up to a partner power just through investing in it and cultivating it simply because of the pressure of your community and your feelings of valuelessness in that community. And so it's important, you know, in your self-awareness to realize that in a community that you live in, especially if you're an external standard personality, you're probably going to internalize some of the community values of powers that are around you, and you might actually end up adopting certain powers as your main power that maybe aren't actually your main power. And I like to call these shogunate personalities because of the nature of the shogun. In Japanese history, you know, you have this idea of the shogun who really ran things, but the emperor was on the throne. And there are a few of those kinds of situations in communities that have really high pressure for you to be a certain way, you know, whether it's like you need the power of the will and you like pull up by your bootstraps and get things done and work real hard and, you know, rule over others and stand up for yourself. If that's like the community pressure around you, and you happen to be will last, will as your subject power, then you're going to really try very hard to at least look like you're a real tough guy, you know, and that you can get things done. You're going to work really hard. And it may be that what's really, you know, even though it's like I'm will-oriented and you've got that on the throne, the true power behind the throne, the shogun behind the throne, might be one of your other powers. And you're just not able to really fully embrace that, either with yourself or even in your community, because of the pressures of your community to fit into a certain kind of mold. So that's really important to understand that, especially if you're external standard, which means you really care about what the people around you think, whether or not you're meeting their expectations for what you're supposed to be, it's going to be very hard probably for you to have clear self-awareness about where you're at. Because there's all sorts of confusion and pressures from outside and inside for you to internalize those value of powers that might not actually be natural to you. I hope all of that makes sense. It can be a little confusing. It might be helpful to have a diagram of these things. And if I were a more visual thinker, I'd probably have created a diagram for you. So you didn't just have to listen to me, you know, run through all the permutations and talk about all these things. But I hope this is sensible enough. If it's not, you know, leave me a comment or a question and I'd be happy to try to answer it. So next episode, we're going to be talking about the disorders of the powers. And that's really fascinating as well, because obviously we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a fallen world. And so it's not usually the case that you can rely on these 12 basic personality types to function at their best. Oftentimes there's even more variety in humanity because of those 12 basic personality types being twisted and distorted through all sorts of different kinds of exploitations and abuses of the powers that can occur internally. So we're going to talk about all that. Thanks for joining me and for riding along on this series on the three powers. And until next time, God bless you.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.